Good afternoon, it's Mountain Edition. I'm Elise Thatcher.
And I'm Marcy Quivenen. Governor Hickenlooper visits Aspen and talks about climate change.
A man arrested for stealing pot from an Aspen dispensary gets transferred to a local jail.
General Wesley Clark was in Aspen for our day. He discussed renewable energy, national security, and climate change.
Aspen's critically dependent on snow. What are we going to do in Aspen if the snow season declines?
A new Colorado law around DUIs might make life a little safer in the Roaring Fork Valley.
The orange plume that swept through the Animas River near Durango was due to mining pollution. Could the same disaster happen here?
A catastrophic release? Yeah, the chances are decent that it could happen in Aspen or anywhere else in the state.
Finally, we tour an efficient new building in Basalt. RMI's Innovation Center is more than halfway complete. Basalt officials hit the pause button Tuesday on a preliminary review of development options for a controversial parcel. How or whether to develop the land could go to a public vote.
Tensions were high before the meeting started, as the crowd argued over the best way to handle the Pan and Fork parcel near downtown. During public comments, one attendee named the underlying concern this way.
Everybody perceives, whether it's true or not, that we're in bed with somebody. And that's really, it may not be true and nothing that, but you cannot get rid of the stigma.
A current preferred option for the land would involve a hotel, townhouses, and other elements. Last night, council members were voting on something called a pre-development agreement. If approved, the town of Basalt would work with the Roaring Fork Community Development Corporation and Low Enterprises on how much development options could cost. Council member Gary Tenenbaum decided against such an agreement, noting public interest and confusion.
Is going to be a public vote on where we go with this. And I think that's great that we are a democracy and let's vote on it.
It was a 3-3 tie vote for council members. With town trustee Rick Stevens absent, a swing vote wasn't possible. The Aspen man accused of robbing a local pot dispensary is back in Pitkin County. He had been held in St. Louis after a high-speed car chase with police. Aspen Public Radio's Carolyn Sakuriasin reports.
A paperwork mix-up in St. Louis County put Hayden May in the custody of local authorities. Law enforcement in Missouri never served him the arrest warrant related to the high-speed chase he led police on and the resulting head-on collision with an officer. That meant he could no longer be in the custody of St. Louis County. Hayden will first be prosecuted here on felony charges related to the robbery at Stash, fleeing police, and stealing a car. After this case is completed, he will be prosecuted in St. Louis, where he faces other felony charges, including assaulting a police officer. He is being held on a $100,000 bond in the Pitkin County Jail. Carolyn Sakuriasin in Aspen Public Radio News.
Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper was in Aspen earlier this week for a discussion at the Aspen Institute. He touched on a range of issues, including foreign policy, teen pregnancy, marijuana, and climate change.
On climate change, Hickenlooper says it's important to have clean air at high altitude. He supports President Obama's climate action plan and intends to enact it in Colorado. He says the state has an obligation to help communities affected by the new rules, where coal is a big employer. He favors natural gas production, saying it's much cheaper than coal. Last weekend, there were extra eyes watching drivers in Glenwood Springs. Cameras were set up as part of a traffic flow study, which will influence stoplight changes this winter.
It all started because of complaints about crossing and getting onto Highway 82 in Glenwood. David Oldham helps oversee regional traffic operations for the Colorado Department of Transportation, or CDOT.
I probably could say there's been some concerns about the wait times on side streets. There are times someone waiting on the side street could wait upwards of 2, maybe even 2.5 minutes to cross the highway or turn onto the highway.
It's better to keep the wait to 1, maybe 1.5 minutes. Drivers have voiced concerns about another issue, too.
There's been some complaints about individuals catching multiple red lights when they probably should have caught a green light.
So a consulting firm will be reviewing footage from the weekend, looking at how many cars were waiting at side streets. Consultants got some real-time data, too, by driving 82 in Glenwood.
To get a feel for the travel time, how long does it take to get from one end to the other? And the corridor of study is mainly from the 6th and Laurel intersection to Highway 82 and Blake Street on the south side of town.
Results from the study should be complete in September. Oldham says traffic lights likely will be updated this winter before early construction begins on the Grand Avenue Bridge. But drivers shouldn't get their hopes up too much.
There's many different methodologies for updating the timing for a signal, and we don't want to make any large promises that will vastly improve traffic. The goal is to improve the flow of traffic, but we don't want to make it seem like we're improving a horrible condition and making it great. There's limited options for us with signals on how much we could truly improve traffic conditions.
Because the highway's already at capacity and there's traffic both commuting through Glenwood Springs and locals just trying to get across town, Oldham promises to time the lights as best as possible prior to the new Grand Avenue Bridge construction next year and again after it's built.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Marcy Griffin, and if you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Dan Haley is the new head of the state's largest oil and gas industry trade group, the Colorado Oil and Gas Association.
He sat down with State House reporter Benta Berkland and talked about the industry and the Western Slope, among other topics.
Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've heard some concerns from residents along the Western Slope in Garfield County where they're worrying that the safety and the monitoring isn't as high a priority as it would be on the Front Range. Have you heard that concern? Is that something you guys are grappling with?
I have not heard that individual concern. I was on the Western Slope doing some tours. I went out on a rig tour, met with a citizens group, met with some economic development types. Some of the things I did hear were people on the Western Slope are concerned when we're on the Front Range and we're developing rules that impact the entire state and they have a different business.
Any policy specifics you can shed light on at this stage for next session, or is it too early to say?
In terms of what people can expect to see out of COGA, I think it's a lot of the same things we've been doing in the past. That is that community outreach, getting out into those communities, talking to them about what they're saying with development, being involved in the legislative and regulatory process so we can, you know, hopefully influence a positive outcome for the oil and gas industry. Some of the things we're working on are liquefied natural gas export, the project that's happening on the Western Slope right now. Governor Hickenlooper, in fact, just wrote a letter in support of building a LNG export facility in Coos Bay, Oregon, which would open new markets for natural gas on the Western Slope.
You spent 20 years in journalism and you served as the editorial page editor at the Denver Post, and then you moved to the private sector to do media consulting. Talk about this role that you're now embarking on and how you think that media background and savvy will help you.
Sure. Well, I spent the past year as a consultant doing media and political work for several corporate clients, but I also had a lot of oil and gas interest in that. One of my clients was the Colorado Oil and Gas Association. So it was nice that I was already sort of a part of the organization, understood it, began to really understand the industry and took a liking to it. And I really hope that I can take some of what I learned over the years in media and really better communicate some of the positive aspects of this industry to people in Colorado. So they know that when you talk about oil and gas, you're not just talking about the fuel you put in your car. You're talking about everything that you touch almost every day, from the clothes we wear to the makeup that women put on in the morning to the iPhone or Android that we use throughout the day are all petroleum products. But then also how important it is to our country, energy independence, energy security, all those different aspects, and really use my communications background to tell that story in unique and interesting ways.
This kind of parlays into the next question, but what do you think the biggest challenge is that's facing the oil and gas industry in Colorado?
A couple things. Right now, clearly the pricing environment. It's been interesting to watch, though, how resilient this industry is, to where you're selling basically oil for $80, $90 a barrel and now dealing with $48, $50 a barrel oil, yet they're able to keep production levels in 2015 about where they were in 2014. And across the country in 2015, we're going to have a record-setting year for oil production. So that's been very interesting to watch, the resiliency of the industry and the people who work in it. Also, I think the other thing is community outreach, making sure we're out talking to people in those communities that are impacted by oil and gas, letting them know what's happening in their communities. If we're not out having those conversations, other people will fill that vacuum and give them what I consider bad information, try to scare them, and we don't want that to happen.
Is there anything the industry needs to do differently?
I think we're learning over the years that community outreach is important. A couple years ago, I would have said that's one of the things the industry would need to do different. But we learned, we saw what happened in communities that didn't get the best information, and they banned fracking in 2012 and 2013. That was a big learning moment for the industry to say, we can't just expect to win these elections based on, you know, our past and our stature as the oil and gas industry. We need to go out and educate people.
Thanks. We appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you very much.
That was Dan Haley. He is the new head of the Colorado Oil and Gas Association. I'm Benta Berkland in Denver.
General Wesley Clark is an R-Day Summit veteran. The event was in Snowmass Village earlier this week, spotlighting renewable energy and leaders in the field. Clark returned for this year's edition,
this time to speak about the United States' dependence on oil and its potentially disastrous effects. As Aspen Public Radio's Patrick Fort reports, Clark's current battle is to attack climate change, which could have major implications for ski resorts.
When Wesley Clark ran for president in 2004, he tried to get the nomination on a platform of healthcare and tax reforms.
He speaks four languages, but his actions speak more eloquently than words. He can get our country moving on jobs and healthcare.
And although he was the winner of a state primary, John Kerry took the nomination. The Democrats were defeated and George W. Bush began his second term in the White House. But while the Bush legacy continued in Washington, Clark began to focus his efforts in on other parts of the policy world. After a stint as a military advisor, he began to work on environmental issues and climate change. He comes to our day this year to talk about America's reliance on energy sources as they relate to our military involvement in other countries.
The Gulf War of 1990-91 was fought for oil. It was absolutely, totally clear and admitted by the former Secretary of State, James Baker.
That was Clark talking during one of the discussions at the R-Day Summit yesterday in Snowmass Village. Clark says he's pleased that the big players in the commercial energy industry in China have been brought in for the four-day forum. An EPA study a few years ago found that China put out about a quarter of the world's greenhouse gases, a few percentage points more than the United States. Now that Clark has dipped his toes into the world of environmental policy, he says it isn't just the large cities that need to be taking charge. Small towns need to also consider how climate change affects them, especially if the very livelihood of an area is at the whim of Mother Nature. If climate change sends a place into environmental chaos, he says, people will start to get very worried.
Aspen's critically dependent on snow. What are we going to do in Aspen if the snow season declines? We've already had a couple of winters up here where it didn't snow much before Christmas. That's scary to people up here. Climate change affects every community in America, and that means that communities have to be on guard to look at the local effects, and then they have to weigh in.
Wesley pointed out that the ski resorts have had to close early because of the lack of snow. He says people were concerned then. He realized how dependent America was on foreign energy during his time in the military. That was when the light went off. Now he says that the United States has dug itself into a very deep hole for the sake of oil.
Well, it's distorted America's foreign policy. It's caused three wars. It's cost us trillions of dollars. It's cost us 7,000 U.S. dead. We've disrupted the Middle East over this. We've fed terrorism. We've created a monster. And it all started at Spindletop in Texas or someplace with Rockefeller in Pennsylvania and Ohio. And who could have understood then
Wesley has been in nearly every field of policymaking that there is. He's been in the military, where he served as a general. He's served as a board member of several defense groups. He's also run his own business and been involved in multiple investment firms. Clark is currently the co-chair of Growth Energy. He says all this experience makes it necessary for him to do what he can to help environmental causes.
You know, I've been very lucky because I've seen business at the top, military at the top, and government at the top, and politics at the top. And there aren't that many of us who've had those kinds of experiences. And I think it puts first of all, it's been a real privilege, but I think it puts a real obligation on you as well.
Through all of his experiences, Clark says he hopes that our day can bring in more people to get the discussion going, to ensure that real, meaningful change can come out of the conferences like this. He thinks that bringing in the right people will make that happen.
Well, I hope we'll get this conference will grow and become even more attractive. We need to bring more scientists, more technologists, more financial, more policy people, more state and local leaders to come to a place like this to see the shape of the future.
Patrick Fort, Aspen Public Radio News.
There are differing opinions about whether a Gold King mine disaster could happen in Aspen's backyard.
The spill let loose 3 million gallons of contaminated water into the Animas River in southwest Colorado. It was accidentally triggered by a contractor for the Environmental Protection Agency. I explored whether such a catastrophe could happen here. The spill turned the Animas bright orange and halted river access in an area known for rafting. Businesses reliant on the river aren't the only casualties. Communities that pulled drinking water have shut off connections. The plume has moved downstream into New Mexico and Utah and will eventually reach Lake Powell. When Aspen pilot Bruce Gordon saw it Sunday, the brilliant color was fading.
By that time, the plume had you know, I think they found the plume down near Farmington. It was down on the New Mexico border, the main part of the plume.
He says the water was still discolored.
But the remnants and the sediments, you know, on the edges of the river were very pronounced. But nothing was as vivid as that original photos where we saw the kayakers sort of in the, like yellow finger paint.
The release happened Wednesday. An EPA team was working to install a concrete plug in an inactive mine when a dam broke and spewed wastewater into a tributary of the Animas.
It was a terrible tragedy, inadvertent accident. The goal of the project was to prevent what happened from happening.
Bruce Stover is director of the Colorado Inactive Mine Reclamation Program. There are more than 20,000 abandoned mines in the state. 600 of them are in Pitkin County.
You know, we're not aware of any issues similar to what happened last week down in San Juan County in Pitkin County.
He says water that collects in unused mines on Aspen Mountain drains, so water doesn't build up in pools like it did at Gold King. Still,
there could be some other smaller mines here and there in Pitkin County that might have a discharge, and any inactive or abandoned mine, you know, unattended and not inspected and no one's underground, you can always have a cave-in or a roof collapse that will then trap the water that's normally flowing. And if the pressure builds up enough, you can get these things to surge and blow out.
In mining lingo, it's called a hiccup, and it's possible in Pitkin County. But Stover says a disaster of the magnitude seen on the Animas is unlikely. Pitkin County Commissioner Patty Clapper agrees.
Not that we don't have mine concerns here. We have mine shaft concerns. We have mine tailings concerns here, but nothing to the extent they have over in that part of the state.
The state has blocked public access to 80 hazardous abandoned mines in Pitkin County and reclaimed 350 acres of mining-disturbed property, like piles of tailings. In the 1980s, Clapper got involved with the EPA that labeled Smuggler Mountain a Superfund site. An analysis at the time showed high levels of toxic metals in soil, but the Roaring Fork River wasn't contaminated.
We tested to be the cleanest community in the country for blood lead levels in our children because of the mining process that was not used here and because of the makeup of our geology.
Do you have any concept of whether something like this could happen in this region?
We have something like 23,000 abandoned mines in the state of Colorado.
Mark Williams is a professor of geography at CU Boulder.
Almost all of them are at high elevation in steep mountain areas. Most of those have cave-ins, and so the chance of a pool forming is high. So a catastrophic release yeah, the chances are decent that it could happen in Aspen or anywhere else in the state.
He's working with the EPA on a mine near Creed, where millions of gallons of toxic water have collected. If released, he says it would be an even bigger disaster than Gold King. In Durango Tuesday, Governor Hickenlooper predicted river recreation would return within a week.
We want to take no risks, right? But we want to get everybody back to the river they love as quickly as possible.
The appearance of the animus may be the worst part. Again, Hickenlooper.
I am very, very confident there will be no long-term ill effects, that the heavy metals, I mean, we've had runoffs of heavy metals many times before. They're going to wash through. We don't think we're testing the fish, testing the water. If there's any problem, we'll take care of it.
His visit to the affected area followed a disaster declaration from his office earlier in the week. Meanwhile, the Colorado Department of Public Health reports initial tests on the animus show the concentration of contaminants continues to decrease.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elise Thatcher. To stay up to date with news in the Roaring Fork Valley, follow us on social media. Like us on Facebook, find Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, or follow us on Instagram. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station.
Colorado law might make life a little safer in the Roaring Fork Valley.
If someone is caught driving drunk for the fourth time, a new statewide law makes that a felony offense. Sherry Kaloya is district attorney for the 9th Judicial District. She explains the number of people a year that usually are arrested for drunk driving for the fourth time.
It probably means that we will have initially maybe 10 to 15 cases that have to be filed or can be filed under the felony DUI.
If convicted, the offender could serve up to 6 years in state prison. Previously, drunk drivers in Colorado could get only misdemeanor charges as long as they didn't get into an accident. The new felony law went into effect last week, so an offender has to be arrested that day or afterwards to be eligible.
And I don't think I'd want to be the first person in the county to get that charge because we're going to be looking at that pretty hard.
You know, obviously the impact of increasing the penalty range available to the court is probably a good thing.
Lawson Wills is a defense attorney in Glenwood Springs. He handles lots of DUI cases in the Roaring Fork Valley and finds most clients learn their lesson after getting caught once. Wills explains the consequences if a driver continues to drink and drive.
A second one, you are going to go to jail. A third one, you're going to go to jail for 60 days at a mandatory minimum. And when you go to jail for 60 days, you don't pay your mortgage, you lose your job, probably lose your family. Now, somebody that doesn't remember that and goes out and creates a fourth one is somebody that really has issues with alcohol. So a felony probably is appropriate at that point.
Like Kaloya, Wills estimates there won't be a lot of DUI cases that fall into that category, so he doesn't anticipate the new law will affect his business that much. The new law is projected to cost the state between $2 and $4 million a year. Kaloya anticipates it'll cost more for her office, too, to prosecute those cases, but she says it's worth it.
I think we need to start somewhere, and I'm really glad we do have this, whatever level it is. Let's see how it works, and hopefully it will deter some people from getting in their cars after they've been drinking.
Construction is more than halfway done on what's expected to be one of the most energy-efficient buildings in the world.
Rocky Mountain Institute's Innovation Center in Basalt will house offices and a large conference and community room. I took a tour of the 15,000-square-foot building. A construction crew is busy hammering, digging, and painting. The building's taking shape. It's hard to miss along Two Rivers Road. Michael Kinsley with Rocky Mountain Institute stands at the entrance.
So we're about, a 1 minute walk, maybe 2 minutes from downtown Basalt.
When fully built, RMI staffers will do research here, and industry leaders from around the world will convene to discuss making their businesses more energy efficient.
It's a super efficient building, and if it's the only office building that's built this efficiently, it will not have served its purpose. What its real purpose is to show others that this kind of a facility can be done by organizations that may care nothing about climate or the environment.
He says the business case is convincing and the innovations are impressive. RMI has been giving tours to local architects, engineers, and general contractors.
This building is definitely different and innovative.
Luke Godwin is with J.E. Dunn Construction, the company working on the building.
You know, I've worked on a lot of college campuses that really take it to the extreme on energy savings, but you know, most commercial buildings are not near the caliber of, you know, zero net energy and efficiency as this building.
RMI says the center will be the most efficient building located in a cold climate zone in the United States. It'll generate all of the energy it uses with a rooftop solar system. Rainwater collected in an outdoor pond will water the landscape, and a set of systems indoors will keep the temperature comfortable without a furnace or air conditioning. Luke Godwin pulls a metal rack with coils from the building's air handling system. It's an air-to-air heat exchanger that pulls in fresh, warm summer air and cools it.
So basically, you've got, you know, metal sheets that act to, you know, either take in energy, take in heat, or take in coldness and exchange it into the fresh air that's brought in from outside.
The system, combined with super tight insulation of the walls, roof, and foundation, keep the building a comfortable temperature. Thermostats are everywhere, even in the wall slabs. If one room gets too hot, a system pushes that warm air into a cooler room. RMI's Michael Kinsley.
There are relatively unusual components of this building. So part of the purpose of this building is to break the ice on those new approaches.
As the building goes up, Basalt Town Manager Mike Scanlon has been getting comments from the public.
I think the funniest one for me was there was a fear in the community that the building would be blue. And I had to tell them, that's just the seal that they've put on the outside of the building. There's actually brick and veneer that goes over it.
In a letter to the editor in the Aspen Times, Aspen resident Richard Gordon called the building a horrible, ugly shed that's oversized and out of place. Scanlon says the building fits into the downtown landscape and will bring a new set of visitors to town.
Downtowns across the United States would kill to get something like that in their downtown, and that would include large metropolitan areas. I think having the RMI and their innovation center is quite the coup, and we're fortunate that local people wanted to stay in their community and wanted to invest in it.
The construction marks possibly a new era for Basalt. Town officials are working to determine how to develop downtown, especially on the newly vacant Pan and Fork property. The RMI building is set to open at the end of the year.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. Have a nice afternoon. I'm Elise Thatcher.
And I'm Marcy Krivenin. To hear this show again or download a Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.